conference call on community preparedness. We are very pleased to have Mr. Jim Schwendinger and Ms. Molly Melbourne present. Jim Schwendinger is a nurse practitioner with many years of emergency preparedness and response experience, working for the U.S. Army, the VA medical system, several academic medical centers, and is currently team lead for EpiX and a founding member of the clinician communication team, both within the emergency communication system of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Molly Melbourne is an association program director with over 10 years' experience working with health centers and primary care associations. She currently serves as the director of emergency management for the National Association of Community Health Centers. After the presentation, participants should be able to identify resources related to the U.S. National Response Plan, describe resources for preparedness from CDC and other federal agencies, review the role community health centers can play in community preparedness, and locate more information and resources for community preparedness planning. In compliance with continuing education requirements, all presenters must disclose any financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters, as well as any use of unlabeled products or products under investigational use. CDC, our planners, and the presenters for the seminar do not have any financial or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters. This presentation does not involve the unlabeled use of a product or product under investigational use. I will now turn the call over to Jim Schwendinger.
Thank you, Alicia. I'd also like to thank Molly Melbourne for taking part in this presentation today, and to thank you all for calling in. This is a very important topic, and I'm honored to be able to present. I wanted to state a caveat at the start of the program. It was very daunting to try to collate all the resources and information about this vast topic, and at times it may seem like the flow of the presentation, or at least my part, is all over the map. I beg your indulgence with this and request that you keep in mind that I've tried to approach this on a high level and kind of zoom into the in-the-weeds level of information, and that we will hopefully be able to cover both those levels in order to form a more complete picture of resources that may be available to you, the audience, to better be prepared at the community level, whether that is the federal, state, or local level. The call is to, you know, possibly inform you of resources you may not have been familiar with and to really get the conversation started. If this works the way I'd like it to work and if it works similar to presentations I've given at some of the HHS-sponsored state pandemic summits, this presentation will just have everyone thinking of how they can make their plans more robust and more effective, and how, you know, as importantly, CDC and Molly's group can better provide the resources and the information to help you all in the communities prepare. I'd like to have you go to the first slide, which is titled, Why Take an All-Hazards Approach? The logic of having an all-hazards approach to planning and preparation, in my opinion, is a concept that we all kind of embrace, you know, intellectually, but really have a hard time, you know, doing it in practice, and it can be a little confusing. My personal thought, and this does connect with, you know, the folks I work with, is that, you know, if you can prepare for most things and most of the things that you can think of, you're probably likely prepared for the largest possibility of things. There's certainly some regions of the country and the world have preparedness in place for, you know, certain specific natural disasters, the Gulf Coast and the Eastern Seaboard and the Pacific Islands for hurricanes and tropical storms, the Midwest primarily for tornadoes, the Far West for earthquakes and fires, and, you know, many parts of the country, certainly the Midwest again, for floods. Dealing with all of those may seem like they're very disparate, but they really have a core and a large component that are you know, common. So the main focus of this talk, like I said, was really to say that the better we are, you know, in preparedness for anything kind of makes us better prepared for everything. Next slide, please. Our health protection system is really one that's a network of shared responsibility. There's, you know, interconnected and overlapping and strengthening parts. And we talk about, on this slide, some of the several layers, the multiple layers that illustrate this interconnectedness. You know, the local tribal groups, the domestic and international kind of connection, public and private sectors, federal, state, local, certainly those are all, you know, interconnected layers. I really just wanted to get us thinking of, you know, it's not only just everyone's responsibility, and individually it's all of our responsibilities, but you're not alone. There's certainly infrastructure in place, you know, at the local, state, federal level, and international level, when you think about the World Health Organization and other international groups, that, you know, we're all really working on the same thing. We may be taking slightly different approaches, but we're really focusing on the same thing. And the overall result and the response is much more robust when we collaborate and, you know, share resources and information. Next slide, please. I wanted to start, like I said, high level and talk about some federal planning resources. New in February was the revision of the document formerly known as the National Response Plan, which has now been retitled the National Response Framework. And it emphasizes that the document and the resources which stand behind it are a framework and not necessarily a plan. The name change really was not just arbitrary. When you think about it, any kind of national response framework is going to be a fluid kind of document, a fluid network of information that can be both scalable and adaptable depending on the particular response that's needed. National Response Framework takes the National Response Plan to a higher and more flexible level, like I just said, and it includes, this revision includes many of the lessons learned from the state and local, as well as federal responses that have occurred in the approximately 4.5 years between the two documents. The National Response Framework focuses on response and short-term recovery. It helps articulate the doctrine, principles, and architecture by which the nation prepares for and responds to all hazards, disasters across all levels of government and through all sectors of communities. So in summary, the National Response Framework is an all-discipline, all-hazards plan. It establishes a single comprehensive framework for the management of domestic incidents with some information towards how we would respond to international or global events, and it provides the structure for federal support. And I know that a lot of the folks on the call may be familiar with the emergency support functions that go behind the federal response, but I wanted to review that briefly for those folks that certainly are not familiar. And also, most importantly, I just want people to know, you know, some of them are really self-explanatory as far as, you know, Health and Human Services having responsibility for public health, but some aren't so, you know, logical. Or, you know, may not be as apparent at first glance. So I really wanted folks to just kind of go through the slides with me and see who's responsible for what emergency support function. Next slide, please. So ESF stands for Emergency Support Function. It's a key part of the National Response Framework that looks at the federal government's response to any event or crisis in general. It basically groups, you'll see as we go along, disciplines and discipline kind of functional roles that make sense. And like I said, I used the example earlier of public health response. The roles and responsibilities are grouped by discipline as well as kind of flavor of the event response. So if we briefly just look through that first slide, I just have the first couple of emergency response functions. So ESF-1 is certainly, you know, one of those that's pretty self-apparent, transportation. And what I did is I put in parentheses the primary federal agency that's responsible for that emergency response function. There are others I wanted to point out. There certainly are usually at least three or four agencies that are co-responsible, but there is an agency that is designated as the lead for that emergency response function. And that lead agency is what I've included in the parentheses. So transportation, again, I won't belabor the slide itself. I put these in primarily for reference. Transportation, of course, means, you know, aviation, airspace management, rail transportation, the roads, you know, basically anything transportation related as far as damage and impact assessment and mitigation and recovery. Emergency support function two is communication. That's Department of Homeland Security, the National Communication System. Their topics and responsibilities are pretty self-explanatory. They basically look at the communications infrastructure, and they're very important. ESF 3 is Public Works and Engineering, which this is one that kind of makes me look twice. Department of Defense is actually the primary coordinating agency for Public Works and Engineering. You know, when you think about DOD, well, you think about the Corps of Engineers, and that makes sense. And they're certainly responsible for, you know, the levees, the dams, a lot of the public works infrastructure in the country. ESF 4, firefighting, is primarily U.S. Department of Agriculture through the a lot of work that they've done with, you know, wildlife and wild land management in the country and coordinating a lot of the National Park Service fire activities. Next slide, please. ESF 5 is emergency management on a high level, and of course, as one would think, that's Department of Homeland Security with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. ESF 6, Mass Care Emergency Assistance, Housing and Human Services, again is FEMA. They, you know, as you can think just from the name, the secondary agency underneath the coordinating activities that FEMA performs is Health and Human Services. And as I mentioned earlier, certainly the lead agency is the point, but there are usually a number of sister federal agencies that provide support activities. ESF 7 is Logistics Management and Resource Support. That pretty much all I would think of with that is FEMA. ESF 8 is where HHS comes in. We're responsible for the whole gamut of public health and medical services, from public health to medical services themselves with the disaster medical system, as well as supplies and logistics of the supplies stream through our strategic national stockpile that CDC helps to coordinate. Next slide, please. ESF 9, search and rescue. Again, this is kind of one of those that's self-apparent, FEMA. They do this, and the second agency that's right under FEMA, of course, is the U.S. Coast Guard. ESF 10 is oil and hazardous materials response. That, of course, is the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA. They also deal with other hazardous materials such as chemical, biologic, radiologic, in conjunction with other agencies. As you can imagine, if it's a radiologic event, Department of Energy is clearly going to be in there as a co-lead. ESF 11, Agriculture and Natural Resources, of course, is U.S. Department of Agriculture. ESF 12 is Energy, again, which is fairly self-apparent, the Department of Energy. Next slide, please. ESF 13, Public Safety and Security. This is another one that originally I would not think, but actually the lead coordinating agency on that is the Department of Justice. And they are responsible for facility and resource security, as well as law enforcement activities. ESF 14, long-term community recovery, again, is a FEMA lead response. And last but not least, ESF 15, external affairs. FEMA leads that, and that is everything from emergency public information to media and community relations, congressional and governmental affairs, and tribal and insular affairs. And HHS has a key role in support of FEMA with their external activities under ESF 15. Again, I just wanted folks to be familiar, and perhaps, you know, these slides could be used as a reference. I think it's important to see that, you know, the agencies that are responsible for each emergency support function, if you have an idea of who to think, you know, to contact and to reach out to, that might make the actual connection and getting what resources you need that much easier. Next slide, please. I just wanted to highlight a couple of resources in addition to the the National Response Framework. The National Incident Management System document, which we all abbreviate to NIMS, is a really important document to know. It really looks at kind of the meat and potatoes of the National Response Framework. And it shows how the government and all the agencies that are outlined with responsibilities under the emergency support functions, how they really organize and manage their infrastructure. And it really, NIMS Some NIMS classes, I admit, can be kind of tedious, but having a familiarity with NIMS will pay off, I think, you know, tenfold in the future to really understand about how agencies are set up and the different arms of an agency that would be responsible for, say, logistics and operations and communications. So having a familiarity with that, I think, again, will pay off, you know, many-fold in any kind of public health emergency. The other document I have on this slide is a CDC document, and it is the Public Health Emergency Response Guide for state, local, and tribal public health directors. If you're not a public health director, don't feel that this document is not worth your time. It's really a good all-hazards reference tool for health professionals of any type, and, you know, the clinician team really defines clinician a little more broadly than some might think. We include, of course, healthcare providers and hands-on care providers such as physicians, nurses, pharmacists, veterinarians, but we also intentionally include public health planners, preparedness coordinators, such as hopefully most of this call, and first responders, to not only include emergency medical services or EMS, but also public safety officers like police and fire. So with that in mind, that explains why I said that if you're not a public health director, this document still may prove valuable for you. It really looks at what the public health response during the acute phase or the first 24 hours of an emergency or a natural disaster would be from the CDC standpoint. I think that it's very, very good information to know and also enable you to better coordinate the CDC response into your own jurisdiction's public health plan and emergency response plan. Next slide, please. I wanted to talk about something I just learned about last week, and this takes NIMS one step further. It's actually an online computer program called NIMS IRIS. We love our acronyms in the government. IRIS, in this case, stands for the Incident Resource Inventory System. It's basically a software tool that allows emergency responders and public health planners to enter resources based on a FEMA and governmental standard definition. So, you know, if you were in an event and you needed a health communication person, that would pretty much cover a lot of duties. But if you looked in using NIMS IRIS and said, hey, I want someone to go out and talk to communities, well, that would tell, you know, FEMA as the coordinating agency, okay, they need a public information officer or a public, public spokesman kind of person or a press officer. And that would allow them to more quickly and efficiently identify potential deployees so that they could help you have the people that you need to be able to better respond to the emergency. On the slide is the direct URL for the FEMA library link to download IRIS. I really encourage you to take a peek at it if you have any role at all in emergency response and preparedness planning, which I assume everyone on this call would. And this is just really good to know that, you know, FEMA refers to X person in X way, so that, you know, when it's in the middle of an event, you don't have to go searching and try to explain. If you can use the nomenclature that we're used to using in the government, you are much more likely to quickly get what you need and who you need. Next slide. Some other federal planning resources with an eye towards all hazards. Certainly the CDC Emergency Preparedness Response website, which is very robust. We have a sister team in the emergency communication system that devotes themselves to maintenance and updating and new information on the CDC website. The FEMA Plan Ahead site, I personally refer patients and, you know, neighbors and anybody that asks, you know, what can I do to get prepared? This site is wonderful. This and ready.gov, which is the next bullet, between the two of them, they have, you know, information about how to get a kit together, how to get an emergency plan together, everything from home and individual preparedness up to community-level preparation. They're really wonderful sites that I can't say enough about, and I really encourage you, you know, to share them with your patients and your coworkers and your clients as far as informational resources on how they can be prepared for all hazards. Next slide, please. I already spoke a bit about this, but I wanted to talk about, illustrate an example of how ReadyGov is just wonderful. in their Get a Kit page, and actually they have a couple pages titled Get a Kit, they really have, you know, lists, which are wonderful. I mean, you can have people print them out and go to the supermarket, or, you know, sit down with a couple of square feet, possibly, or cubic feet in their garage, and think about, okay, what do I have to have? And basically use it as a checklist. And on the slide, I won't belabor it, but we talk about, of course, water, 1 gallon per person per day, which that's a very common question. People are a little confused about, you know, okay, well, how much? I want my family of four. Well, I mean, I think, you know, using a baseline of 1 gallon per person per day at least gives you a place to start. Food as well. It talks about, you know, 3-day supply of non-perishable food. The battery-powered or hand-cranked radios, including a weather radio, that may be something that people might not think about. You know, a flashlight with extra batteries. I mean, certainly, you know, should be apparent, but may not be. A first aid kit, a whistle to signal for help, a dust mask. I won't read the rest of this, but like I said, this list I think is a good place to start. And, you know, to me, it really goes back to the basics of survival. You know, what do you need to survive out in the middle of nowhere? You need fresh water, you know, fresh, clean water, you need food, clean air, and you need warmth or some kind of shelter. If you start with a list like this, you can certainly, you know, modify it and you know, personalize it, but it really does give you a good basic start. Next slide, please. They also have a very good page that talks about things to consider, which in the clinician team, we really try to press this forward, and in our Hurricane Katrina response, we were able to help a little bit with one of these items, which I'll elaborate on in a moment. But basically, things that people may not think about, you know, chronic prescription medications, you know, glasses, an extra pair of glasses, medical information, which is, you know, very important and often overlooked, pet food if you have pets, you know, important documents, and again, here's where you have to kind of think about, okay, if it's a fire, I may not be able to get out of the house with all my important documents unless they're in one place or a fireproof safe. But an all-hazards approach, again, if you have these kind of things thought through ahead of time, it certainly should make, you know, having access and retrieving these documents while you evacuate, if that's what's called for in the situation, that much easier. And I won't belabor this. The list is pretty self-explanatory. I did want to mention, like I said at the beginning, during Hurricane Katrina response, we were able, with a lot of the programs within CDC, to help develop what came to be known as Kiwi. And we thought of a little cute, you know, southern hemisphere bird. But in this case, it's K-I-W-Y, and it stands for Keep It With You Medical Information. It's basically a front and back page of, you know, an 8.5 by 11 size piece of paper that includes, you know, important information about health diagnoses, allergies, current medications, medical and surgical history, and other really important and significant information that should be attainable to anyone providing care. You know, and certainly, again, the assumption for anyone that's been involved with emergency medicine, you know, the assumption is that you come upon this person, you know, that can't respond and can't give you, oh, I'm allergic to penicillin, or I'm, you know, I had a pacemaker. And, you know, these are all things that really are important sometimes, depending on the actual, you know, intervention that the person needs. But, you know, the more information, the better. So that's, and I gave the URL for the Kiwi on the CDC website. I encourage you, if you don't know what I'm talking about, to go to our website and look up Kiwi and see if that's something that might be helpful to you and your community and your clients in their preparedness planning. One bullet I would like to outline is I really like how the Ready.gov folks talked about chlorine bleach. And they have a section that talks about, you know, household chlorine bleach and a medicine dropper. And people might think, why? Well, I mean, chlorine bleach can be used for a bunch of things. Certainly it's a disinfectant for surfaces and, you know, can clean up potentially infectious kind of sources. But also it's a water purifier. You can dilute it 9 parts of water to 1 part bleach, and it actually, it's not the best tasting or smelling water in the world, but it's certainly potable. And it can also be used to treat, you know, water as far as a disinfectant for, you know, cleaning or, you know, for wound care, things like that. So I really liked how they included that, where truthfully I think a lot of other preparedness information that I've seen for individuals and families don't really explain why you should have the bleach and why you should have a measuring device. So I really like how the Ready.gov folks point that out. Next slide. I would be remiss for not mentioning my team, the Clinician Outreach Communication Activity, the Clinician Communication Team within the Emergency Communication System here at CDC. We have a free email update service that you can go to our website and sign up for, and we put out weekly, at least, informational updates with what's new in the emergency preparedness response arena as far as CDC goes. During an event or a public health emergency, we often increase the frequency of those updates, and it's always a good resource to be aware of things you may not otherwise have been aware of. We sponsor at least monthly COCA calls, such as this one, on various topics. We have a call coming up next month on MRSA, infection control, and we've had calls of, you know, certainly about pandemic influenza and H5N1. So it's really a good resource. And on our website, too, you can see our library of past calls. And after each call, we post not only the transcript of the call, but also an audio recording and a copy of the slides, which you all hopefully have in front of you, so that it's nice to go back. And recently, we've been able to add continuing education credits, CME, CNE, CHES, and a number of other disciplines, continuing education credit for our calls and participation in our calls. So please, you know, if you have a licensure that requires you to have continuing education, it's a nice, easy way to not only stay up to date and, you know, hear a presentation by the subject matter experts at CDC and outside, but also to get a little bit of continuing education credit there. So I really encourage you to go check out our website. The last thing I really want to mention is if you have a question certainly about this call, and we'll wrap this up at the end, or any emergency preparedness response topic that CDC covers, feel free to email us at coca@cdc.gov. And we find the answer, whether that's finding it on our website or extant resources or contacting the subject matter experts and obtaining an answer from them. So that's kind of a nice free service that we provide to be able to, you know, ask a rabies question of the rabies experts, or, you know, any other topic that we cover. Next slide. Another resource I definitely wanted to mention, possibly in brief, the slide kind of says it all. Some of you on the call certainly are on EPIX. It stands for the Epidemic Information System, Exchange System, sorry. And it's really a secure system that most of the state and territorial epidemiologists, the public health directors, the public health lab directors, and those others that you can see on the bullets participate in and really can share, you know, provisional information. It is a secure system, and we do know who's on, and, you know, they have to be validated and basically approved for access to EPIX by their state health official, or if they're in the federal government, a designated official within the government. And there is a lot of information sharing that's provisional. I like to give an example that during the mumps outbreak in the Midwest in 2006, there was a lot of information shared before it even hit the media that, you know, people were seeing mumps cases in a higher number than was expected. So if there's any questions, you know, definitely feel free to look at the CDC website for EPIX, and that's just www.cdc.gov/EPIX, hyphen or not, doesn't matter. And then we have the EPIX email. If you, you know, are in a role of preparedness, public health response, one of these roles on the slide here, and you're not in EPIX, please email the help desk and we can talk to you about how to get on. Next slide. 1-800-CDC-INFO is a kind of hidden jewel, I think. A lot of folks don't know that CDC has contracted with a company called Vangent Government Solutions for about the last 4 years to provide a toll-free, free, no-fee service to anyone, the public, clinicians, public health folks like yourself, to basically call in and ask any question, and we get some doozies, you can imagine, about what CDC does and about public health. They're always there, 24/7, 365. They don't get Christmas off or New Year's. They have direct connection to the CDC Emergency Operations Center if, you know, a public health person calls with something that could be a public health event just starting, or for a clinician that has a patient that may have a communicable disease, certainly one of the ones that we do surveillance on, there is a mechanism that they can easily connect you directly to the subject matter expert for that topic. There's going to be some triage, of course, as you can imagine, in there to make sure that that's the appropriate response. But if that is the appropriate response, you will be connected with, you know, the CDC expert on call for rabies or for smallpox or anthrax, for example. They do have a large library of what they call prepared responses in their information database. They can respond to inquiries. Those are all cleared and provided by subject matter experts and are continually updated. The other thing I like to mention is that in addition to the telephone and email resource, inquiry resource service they provide, they can also provide select CDC publications via a fulfillment center. So if you are looking for, you know, a poster of the latest immunization guidelines, you could call CDC Info. They could likely get that to you for free and mail it to you, email, mail, whatever, whatever the best, you know, kind of format that would serve your purposes would be. So I put both the phone number and the email on there. If you've never dealt with CDC Info, I invite you after this call to call them up and say, hey, I want to know about, you know, anthrax or smallpox or whatever your particular topic might be. Next slide. Very briefly, just some other federal planning resources specifically for pandemic influenza. Again, I really wanted to focus on all hazards, but I know that a lot of us are spending a lot of time dealing with pandemic influenza plans. These are two wonderful documents. If you haven't looked at them yet, they're really good resources, so you may not find yourself reinventing the wheel. The HHS document on the left is very robust and has, you know, a breakdown, maybe more towards the public health folks in the audience, but that look at everything from laboratory testing, diagnostic confirmation, clinical care issues, vaccines, antiviral, and other other countermeasures. So it's really a good document to look at, and that is on the pandemicflu.gov page. They also have a direct link to the document on the right, which is the federal government's national strategy for pandemic influenza, which is also a little higher level, but again, I think just like the national response framework, it's important to really know what the government's planning. So, you know, the states and the locals and even, you know, if we have, and I'm certain we do, or I hope we do, you know, some business folks on the phone that, you know, really can allow you to better incorporate your own particular plans into the federal response to all hazards, in this case for a pandemic influenza event. But certainly anything in these two documents can be extrapolated for an all hazards kind of approach. Next slide. Pandemicflu.gov, I mentioned it on the previous slide, but I like to highlight that there's checklists that are specific for these sectors, you know, state and local planning, business planning, preschool and other schools, colleges, universities, faith-based community organizations, individual physicians' offices and care practices, home health, EMS, and there's some future plans for a correctional facility checklist, as well as, my slide's out of date. I should have put long-term care facilities. That was just added a couple of weeks ago. So, and these are certainly evolving, and, you know, if there's a checklist that's not on the pages, feel free to email them and, you know, say, hey, what about this sector? And, you know, they're likely either working on it or, you know, you may provide the seed that gets them working on it. Next slide, please. Some preparedness challenges, and I will briefly go through these because I don't want to eat into Molly's time. These are fairly self-explanatory, but like I said at the beginning, I wanted this to just get the brain kind of, you know, functions going and all of us thinking about what we have to prepare for. So I won't belabor the list, but the bullets here talk about, you know, disruption of services, police, fire, EMS, telephone, you know, utilities, water, sewage, garbage collection, you know, our health infrastructure not being there, either because of staffing or resources or one of the above, they don't have power or water, communication, transportation, supplies, and I put in parentheses non-retail, and I'll explain that in a moment, and then community infrastructure such as schools and retail services. Next slide, please. So again, disruption services, I think these are all fairly apparent. You know, any plan should really take these into account. What do you do if the police are busy doing something else and they can't really respond to, you know, either certain calls or any calls dealing with traditional police services? Same thing for fire and EMS. Government services people might not think about. The U.S. mail, entitlements for those, you know, those of us that deal with clients that get, you know, Medicare or Medicaid, or have any kind of disability income or any other government entitlement, resource agencies such as social services and DFACs. You know, what do we do if the WIC, the people that receive women and infant and children services, can't get their WIC connection? You know, can't either get the vouchers or can't get access to enroll. I mean, that's something that a lot of us don't really think about in our planning. We don't necessarily get down to that fine level of granularity. Next slide. Utilities, again, water, electricity, gas, telephone service, cable and other TV services. I mean, people rely on CNN and Fox and the other 24-hour news networks, not endorsing any, you know, for their information, or the Weather Channel. What do you do when that's all of a sudden gone? Sewage service is something we definitely don't think about a lot. What do we do if all of a sudden there's no one, you know, maintaining the sewers and they don't work anymore? Or if you have a septic tank that needs servicing and you can't get a hold of somebody. Garbage pickup. I mean, those of you in the large cities that have had, you know, the bad luck to deal with a garbage strike, I mean, certainly you know what I'm talking about. It can really disrupt everything. Garbage piles up. It you know, can't have the normal flow of traffic. There's, you know, there's the smell. There's just issues, you know, combined. There's animals. There's all kinds of problems. And we really often take our garbage services for granted. Next slide, please. Health infrastructure, again, decreased or non-existent healthcare services. What do we do if the hospital can't, you know, supply the staff or has to close their doors because they don't have power or water? Molly will certainly jump in a moment and talk about how community health services can help with that. But, you know, certainly they may be faced with that as well. Local clinics, individual provider offices, you know, what do you do if your primary care doc can't see patients? Do you go to the local ER? Do you go to a particular hospital? What if the ER is closed? So, I mean, these are all questions I'm sure have occurred to folks involved in preparedness planning, but I really wanted them on this slide, like I said, to get us all thinking. And, you know, if at the end of this, either in the Q&A or certainly in email, and even just among yourselves, you can start sharing some of the potential you know, responses and adaptations to these challenges. I think that would be the, you know, that would fulfill the purpose of this call as far as I'm concerned. Next slide. Communication, again, telephone, internet, radio. You know, what do we do? If your homebound elderly patient can't pick up the phone and call 911. One of the nice things in some of the state preparedness summits that I was honored enough to take part in, we had a couple of really good brainstorming sessions in a breakout that, you know, people started tossing around ideas, and it was wonderful. I mean, people started saying, hey, you could draft all the neighborhood kids and have bicycle brigades to go check on the homebound and fragile community members. Another person said, hey, we have, they lived in a very rural state out in the upper Midwest. I won't name the state, but, you know, not a lot of infrastructure. But they talked about having a list of their local citizens with four-wheel drive vehicles that were willing to be on call to be used for, you know, EMS transport or even just transport. So, I mean, it's those kind of ideas that I think would be great for us all to, you know, sit down in a giant room and really swap best practices and ideas. And, you know, that kind of synergy is really wonderful when it happens. Next slide. Transportation, again, mass transit. What do you do if all of a sudden there's no buses? What do you do if there's no EMS vehicles? Forget about our own cars. I mean, here in Atlanta, if you all of a sudden took away everybody's personal vehicle, nobody would go anywhere. You know, physical infrastructure. What do you do, like, out in the far west when a bridge collapses, or up in the Midwest, actually, when a bridge collapses or the roads are closed because of, you know, floods or landslides or whatever? Resources, of course, you know, gasoline for the cars, you know, maintenance items. I mean, the last one, you know, I don't think we would necessarily run into that in a couple of weeks or even months. But, you know, if we were in a pandemic event that extended for months to years, who knows? Maintenance items might be an issue for areas that don't have the transportation kind of resources like trucking or rail lines that bring supplies in to the local auto parts store. An idea I wanted to just highlight as far as one of the brainstorming ideas that came out from a state summit was a community had come up with an idea for a community carpool organized by destination and also professional group. And initially I thought, okay, you put all the docs in a car, you put all the nurses in a car. And they said, no, you don't. You split them up. And that makes sense. You don't, if a car gets stuck or, you know, God forbid, is in an accident, you don't want your car full of nurses or physicians stuck. You want to have a nurse in every car, a doctor in every car. And, you know, that's one of those things I wouldn't have thought of, but what a great idea. Next slide. Supplies, again, I said I would get to this. I really mean, you know, the supplies that retail services need to function. You know, I alluded to that in the last slide. What if your rail system and I'm not a trucker, you can tell that. What if your 18-wheelers can't, you know, drive because they don't have fuel or they can't get in by the roads? How the heck are you going to get supplies? How is, you know, your grocery store going to be supplied with new supplies? How's the pharmacy going to get supplies, medications, and things like that? This is something I think that in a lot of the plans that I've been privy to, we really don't address this as well as I think we should. And I really think that our partner division here at CDC is really making inroads into talking with national and international businesses to really start to think about this and plan for this. Next slide. Community infrastructure, schools, businesses, retail services, again. You know, what do we do if our schools are closed? All of us with kids. What are we going to do? We'll drive them to work. You know, what about the daycares? What about, you know, how do we get supplies to fix our furnace if the hardware stores are closed? How do you get groceries? How do you get diapers for your infants? How do you get medication? And again, these are not questions I want to bring up to belabor the point, you know, but we all need to know what the community plans are in regard to the school system, the local business community, et cetera, so that we can better integrate our particular plans, both family and business, or organization, into those plans so that we're not caught short. We assume that the, you know, the Kroger down here is always going to have food. Well, what do we do if all of a sudden the Krogers are closed? So you really need to kind of know what the plans are around you to be able to adapt your own plans accordingly. Next slide. Preparation response, as I mentioned earlier, preparedness is a process which requires the involvement of many individuals and organizations in order to make it more robust, more effective, and work better. Next slide. Issues specific to selected populations, and then I'm going to be briefly going through these and then hand it over to Molly. But we've already mentioned some of these. Certainly some folks to think about that may or may not be on your clientele list include the elderly, homebound individuals, disabled persons, single parents, and, you know, that group would be particularly hard hit if all of a sudden you close the schools and the daycares. What if you can't bring your kid to work? What if your work isn't even open? Certainly that's an issue for anyone with kids, especially maybe single parents. People with chronic illnesses. Others, definitely, that other category can be many, many people. Basically, the sum of this slide is that any planning really should take into account special circumstances, you know, of any number of select diverse groups, such as we've listed and others. Next slide. This is one resource that could help possibly address those groups we were just talking about. The Special Populations Workbook is a document that CDC has developed. It's a work in progress. There's actually been a couple of versions out. My link on this slide may not be the latest version, actually, and I apologize, but this is the version I'm most familiar with. It's a really wonderful document that provides, you know, a process to start thinking about planning that can help support state, local, and tribal planners, you know, when you try to reach a special population. The authors of this work really take pride in not defining what a special population is, because that's really dependent on the community, the event, the chronology, the timing. I mean, what could be a special population at the beginning of an event may be different from the end of an event or in the middle. So they really don't define that, but they give some ideas. And you know, certainly the list that I've had on previous slides apply. But other groups that folks may not think about are, you know, English as a second language group, or folks that aren't fluent in English, recent immigrants, undocumented families. I mean, there's many, many folks that could be considered a special population. And it's not, you know, the purpose of this is not to label them as such, but to just make sure that our plans can really address their needs, which may be different from the mainstream needs. Next slide. Now I would love to turn it over to Molly Melbourne, who has been very, very gracious enough to join me on this call. She is from the National Association of Community Health Centers. Molly?
Great. Thanks, Jim. That was wonderful. Good afternoon. We are really pleased at the National Association of Community Health Centers to have the opportunity to join this call and to talk to all of you about the role of health centers in community preparedness. Many thanks to you, Jim, Carol Simon, Alicia Downs, and the rest of the COCA team for making this happen. Next slide, please. I would like to start off by talking a little bit about my organization, Community Health Centers, and the patients that we serve. NAC, or the National Association of Community Health Centers, has been around for nearly 40 years. The mission of NAC is simple: to promote the provision of high-quality, comprehensive, and affordable health care that is coordinated, culturally and linguistically competent, and community-directed for all medically underserved populations. In short, our mission is essentially to support the health centers so they can support their mission. We do this in a number of ways, such as providing advocacy, education, training, and technical assistance to health centers and their state-based associations called primary care associations across the country. Next slide, please. Community health centers are located in medically underserved areas or serve a medically underserved population. In addition to providing comprehensive primary care, health centers must also include supportive services such as translation and transportation to promote access to the care they deliver. Health centers must also provide a sliding fee scale based on the patient's income level and never turn away a patient even if they are unable to pay the fees. One of the many unique features of health centers is the organization of their board. At least 51% of board members must be patients of the health center. This helps to ensure that the services and programs of the health center are patient-focused and meet the needs of their community. Just as with other healthcare providers, health centers must also meet many requirements for administrative, clinical, and financial operations placed upon them by funders and licensing agencies. When you put all of these things together, these unique characteristics help to remove many of the barriers to care experienced by our target population. For a lot of our patients, the health center is the only source of health care available to them. Next slide, please. The health center program has grown steadily over the last decade, and we now have 1,150 incorporated health centers. These folks have service delivery locations in more than 6,000 areas. As the number of health centers grew, we also placed a focus on maintaining our cost effectiveness as we provide comprehensive and primary care services. We are able to do that at less than $1.50 per day per patient. And I think reflective of this, the Office of Management and Budget recently gave health centers the highest rating of effective in a program assessment. Next slide, please. This slide is a listing of services found in many health centers. Not every health center provides all of these services at all of their locations. Basically, the ultimate combination of services is determined by the needs of their location and the resources that are available to them in that community. Next slide, please. As of November of last year, health center patients numbered 17 million, with 68 million patient visits per year. Health centers serve almost 1 in 3 individuals in poverty across the country. Almost 71% of our patients fell below the poverty guideline in 2006, and nearly 92% of our patients fell below 200% of this line. To help put that in perspective, I think it's helpful to know that in 2006, the federal poverty guideline for a family of four was $20,000. Once you back out the cost of housing, food, and transportation, there's not a lot, if any, left over. We also have a very diverse patient population. Health centers are the medical home to 1 in 4 low-income minority individuals. In 2006, 23% of our patients were African-American and 36% were Hispanic or Latino. This is almost twice the proportion of African-Americans and over 2.5 times the proportion of Hispanic or Latinos reported in the overall U.S. population. In addition, approximately 37% of our patients were children aged 19 or younger, and 7% of our patients were 65 years or older. Health centers also care for 1 in 7 uninsured persons nationally. Close to 40% of our patients are uninsured, and we see this number growing. In 1998, there were 3.9 million uninsured health center patients. By 2006, we were serving 6 million uninsured patients. And for those of you who are counting, that represents a 54% increase in just 8 years. 28.9% of our patients report being best cared for in a language other than English. And I'd like to note that this is a national average. We have many health centers in many communities where 60% or more of their patients are better served in a language other than English. In addition to the demographics that I've already mentioned, health centers are also the medical home for 1 in 9 rural Americans, almost 925,000 migrant farm workers, and 940,000 homeless persons. Next slide, please. In the communities they serve, health centers provide access to vulnerable populations that may not otherwise have access to basic primary care, immunizations, health education, and cancer screenings, to name just a few of the many services available to our patients. Studies have shown that low-income, uninsured people living in close proximity to health centers are less likely to have an unmet medical need and less likely to visit the emergency room or have a hospital stay. Health centers are not just concerned about access to care, they are also very focused on the quality of that care. As evidence of this, several studies have found that the quality of care is equal to or greater than quality of care provided elsewhere. In addition, we are very proud to say that 99% of our surveyed patients report that they are satisfied with the care they receive at their local community health center. Just like in the general population, many of our patients suffer from chronic illness. Health centers consistently meet or exceed nationally accepted practice standards for treatment of chronic conditions. Also, the Institute of Medicine and the General Accountability Office has recognized health centers as models for screening, diagnosing, and managing chronic conditions such as diabetes, cardiovascular disease, asthma, and depression. Our youngest patients also benefit from having a health center in their community. Statistics have shown that communities served by health centers have infant mortality rates at least 10% lower than comparable communities not served by health centers. Lastly, health centers are also good for the health of the economy. Nearly 112,000 full-time equivalents are employed by health centers across the country, and the workforce includes many local community residents. Health centers also bring stability to their community, and this helps to lead to development and economic growth. We truly are in and of our communities. Next slide, please. Emergencies are going to happen whether we are ready for them or not. As the medical home for 17 million patients, many of whom rely on us for their only source of care, we must be ready. We have also learned that our patients will come to us in times of emergencies for care, information, reassurance, and access to resources. As mission-driven organizations and trusted members of our communities, we must build resiliency into our organizations so that we can continue to provide care for our patients even during the most difficult of circumstances. One of the many reasons health centers need to be able to withstand disruptions caused by emergencies is the narrow margin that most health centers face. Even the loss of a few hours of revenue from patient encounters can affect their overall financial well-being. Health centers also need to engage in emergency preparedness to meet accreditation standards and the newly imposed Health Resources and Services Administration program expectations for health centers. Next slide, please. When planning with your local community health center, it's a really good idea to understand what health centers can do during an emergency and what they cannot do. Generally speaking, health centers do not have beds in which to house patients, nor do they treat trauma victims. Ultimately, the role of the health center in your community depends on their location and the size of their facility or facilities, the number of staff, resources, the populations that they serve, and the role that they play every day within your community. The most important role for health centers is to be able to continue to provide health care to our patients during an emergency. Our patients will still get sick, they will still require ongoing treatment for chronic diseases, and will still need preventative care even in the face of a disaster. If the health center can keep their doors open, our patients will continue to come to us rather than adding to an overburdened emergency room. Along those same lines, health centers can clear some of the congestion in emergency rooms following a large-scale disaster or outbreak by taking some of the minimally injured or the minimally ill. This can help protect hospital-level care for those who truly need it. Many health centers provide mental health services on-site and in the languages that best suit their patients and their communities. Getting health centers involved in providing mental health services during and after an event can help take a lot of pressure off the healthcare system in general. As primary care providers, health centers are among the first to see disease outbreaks in their communities. Linking them with public health surveillance can help identify trends and potential problems while they are still at the level of the community. I've talked a lot this afternoon about health centers being very responsive to the needs of their patients and surrounding community, and I think this presents a number of opportunities for health centers to link to hard-to-reach populations through a number of ways, including information dissemination, risk communication, outreach to those folks that already have a relationship with the health center based on trust, and providing staff who speak the languages and live in the cultures of the people in their communities to staff alternate care sites. The other roles listed here, such as utilization of mobile clinics and serving as a pod or point of distribution, are largely based on the capacity of the health center in your community and the resources that are available to them. Next slide, please. There are a lot of larger events listed here on the slide that health centers have had an active role in. For all of these, there are many, many more situations where health centers have played a key role in a community response in situations that did not rise to these same levels. On September 11th, health centers near the World Trade Center provided immediate care to those evacuating the area, including respiratory and eye irritation treatment. Health centers also provided a vital link to their patient population, especially those with limited English proficiency, and disseminated information about the events on September 11th and the following anthrax attacks. Mental health support to our patients and community members related to the attacks continue to this day. In the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, health centers responded to complex and immediate health care needs of the communities affected by this disaster. They dispensed medications to those who fled their homes without them, counseled the troubles, and treated chronic health needs that, if unchecked, would have led to even greater problems. Due to the poor air quality resulting from the wildfires this past October, health centers in Southern California treated patients with respiratory issues, burns, and skin irritation, distributed masks, treated evacuees at shelters, provided medications to those forced to evacuate without them, staffed a 24/7 shelter, conducted home visits to those patients unable to leave their homes, and dispatched mobile clinics. Very recently, a health center in the Kentucky area, directly impacted by deadly tornadoes, set up services to help with the emergency room overflow during and after the storm, augmented hospital staff, and helped combat the problems created by failure of an auxiliary power source at the hospital. One of our health center providers even delivered a health center patient via C-section by the light of a flashlight after the generator failed. Next slide, please. In conclusion, I would like to encourage all of you to reach out to the health centers in your area. We must ensure that all of our efforts include the needs of the vulnerable, underserved populations in all of the phases of emergency management. Work with your community health centers to identify roles that meet the needs of your community and match with the health center abilities and resources. Get them to the planning table. Be sure to include health centers in your plans, in your exercises, any trainings that you conduct, and don't forget about the health centers in your area when you are allocating resources. Next slide, please. This slide provides a number of accesses to help you, a number of resources to help you find health centers in your area. To start, please try to contact your primary care association in your state. As mentioned, this is a state-level association of community health centers. I have a link here to our website, and this is a listing of primary care associations that you can download. In addition, you can visit the HRSA website and search for health centers by the county and the state, and if all else fails, please feel free to contact me. At this point, I would like to turn the call back over to Jim, but I thank you very much for your time and for your attention.
Thank you, Molly. That was great. Thank you for showing how important a role community health centers can be and can play, and, you know, such an integral role that they can be in any kind of community level preparedness. And that means not only, you know, the local community, but I also think for state and regional planning, as well as national level planning on a high level scale, to know that that vast network exists and, you know, is there to be tapped and reached out to. In summary, and I apologize to everyone listening that we're running over our time, but I definitely did want to have some question and answer time at the end, and I will be brief on my two summary slides. My first slide says summary. All hazard preparedness makes sense to me. I mean, again, there's some debate on, you know, all hazard versus specific hazard and event. To me, like I started at the beginning, if we prepare for everything we can think of or most of the things we can think of, that certainly makes us more prepared for just about everything that could happen. Some of the bullets are self-explanatory: natural disasters, hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, terrorist attacks, not only such as we've unfortunately experienced in 2001, but also, who knows, a dirty bomb, you know, an improvised radiologic device, or another bioagent. I mean, we don't know. Known infectious diseases, such as, you know, of course, influenza, unique infectious diseases, and I like to remind folks that are old like me that, you know, back in the early 70s, Legionnaire's disease really kind of caught us off guard when it first kind of surfaced. People didn't know what the heck it was. So, I mean, that's a neat case study to look at how a fairly simple organism can be responsible for a fairly severe public health crisis at the time. But it was ubiquitous. You know, we now know it's ubiquitous in the environment. As well as the last bullet there, infrastructure challenges. And those can be every day. I mean, you lose power in your hospital or, you know, for whatever reason, your staff doesn't show up or enough of your staff doesn't show up that you could open your doors if you're in a healthcare facility. Next bullet, know your current plans and planning resources. And these include what we've gone over today with the federal kind of resources and plans, state, local, community, you know, parts of the community such as the business community and the other ones we've covered. Certainly knowing more in this case when you set down to write or develop or change or modify your plans, the better off you are with that information. Next slide. Determine the needs of your area, organization's community. That's pretty self-explanatory. Develop preparedness plans. That's what we're all here for. Share resources. Like I said, that would be the one thing if I could pull off from this call, that there's a dialogue that will be started and continued long after this call ends. The next bullet, I can't emphasize enough, exercise and evaluate. You know, a plan, President and General Eisenhower had a great quote, which I'll probably get wrong, that says that plans are worthless, but planning is priceless. That's what it is. Plans are worthless, but planning is priceless. And that is a great quote. You know, having something on paper, well, you know what, if you only look at it once a year or dust it off, whatever. If you're in the active process of planning, well, hey, that can be invaluable. And the last bullet, you know, preparedness actions must be taken before an actual event. I can't stress that enough, and anyone that's on the phone that's been in an actual event knows that this one is just one of those kind of facts that if you didn't know it ahead of time, you'll know it afterwards. You know, you really need to think about things before they happen, because right in the middle of it, despite the best, you know, intentions, you can't pull off the same things that you can if you're prepared for it. Next slide. A couple of quick acknowledgments. I want to acknowledge the rest of my team, the Clinician Communication Team, which we're also known as the COCA team, the Clinician Outreach Communication Activity. Here at CDC, Dr. Donna Batts, who's our team lead, Alicia Downs, who coordinates our COCA calls, Jimmy Dills, who introduced me, and myself. We hope to augment our staff in the near future. CDC EpiX, which is my other team, the Epidemic Intelligence Exchange Service. CDC Emergency Communication System, that's my branch. CDC Info, certainly the valuable folks over there that answer the phones. The Emergency Operations Center, the DEO, we call it, the Director's Emergency Operations Center here at CDC. I definitely also want to, in person, thank Carol Simon, who was really the driving force behind the Special Populations Workbook Project and continues to give her expertise and guidance to that project and resource. Next slide. And the following slide, I have a picture which I really think sums up 1,000 words. The quote there, I'm not sure who it is attributed to, but it's a great one. Complacency is the enemy of health protection. And that picture there is from the New York Times about the 1918 pandemic influenza, but I think that it's illustrative of pretty much any event, all hazards-wise, in that, you know, if we're complacent and we don't plan, ooh, we're in trouble. So thank you. I'd like to open it up to some Q&A. I, again, apologize that we ran over time, but if anyone can, you know, stay on the phone for maybe 10 or 15 more minutes, we will have probably 10 minutes or so of Q&A, if there are 10 minutes of Q&A.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To withdraw your request, you can press star 2. One moment, please, for the first question. Again, it's star 1 on your touchtone phone to ask a question.
either that means I put everybody to sleep or they all hung up. Well, I mean, I thank everyone, and I think that if there's a question that occurs to you after some of this sinks in, and I know that it's a lot of information, and I apologize trying to cover this topic, but if a question occurs to you or any kind of questions about the resource, oh, we have a question, but I'll get to that in a second. If you email COCA@CDC.gov, that's COCA@CDC.gov, we'll be happy to try to answer it. I will also direct any questions that are specific to Molly Melbourne about community health centers to her, so if you send those to the same email, COCA@CDC.gov, I will be happy to get those up to her.
Excuse me, I did have a couple questions.
Sure.
Our first question comes from Leonard, so you may ask your question.
Good afternoon. Sorry I wasn't able to open the PowerPoint slides, but being involved with State Defense Force, able to follow along. My question for you is, I hope it's irrelevant, public health having trouble getting the stockpiles distributed. Has any concern been made in reference to maybe looking at State Defense Forces to help, like, increase states' preparedness?
Thank you. That's a great question. I'm sorry you had trouble with the PowerPoint. Were you able to download them?
Unfortunately not.
Oh, is it our link not working?
It would try to start, and then it did not continue.
Okay, well, if you shoot us an email at COCA, I mean, I'll answer your question, but if you send us an email, we can probably send you the slides directly. I do know that the Strategic National Stockpile has been working and looking at different states with regard to both the State National Guard and the State Defense Force. I don't have a lot of details on that, but I definitely could direct that question to the Strategic National Stockpile folks I work with here in emergency support. And I'd be happy to.
That sounds great. Thank you.
Sure.
Once again, if you do have a question, please press star 1 at this time. And our next question comes from William Dickerson.
Hello, Bill Dickerson, Bethesda, Maryland. Enjoyed the presentation. My question, I had never heard of the National Association of Community Health Centers before. How are they funded? Is this is there national funding, or is it all just private support?
We actually are funded through a number of mechanisms. Certainly part of that is through funding through HRSA.
I see. Thank you. That was enlightening.
Great. At this time, there are no further questions.
Okay. Well, again, I'd like to finish the call by turning it back over to Jimmy Gills. But I thank you for your participation. I apologize we ran over. If you have any difficulty getting the slides, which, again, I have a lot of them that were just for reference that I breezed through, please email us at COCA@cdc.gov, and we'll try to get those slides to you. I turn it back over to Jimmy Gills.
And thanks again for providing our listeners with this information. And I want to thank our participants for joining us today. If you didn't get a chance to ask your question, please send an email to COCA@cdc.gov. If you didn't get that for the 15th time, it's COCA@cdc.gov. Recording of this call and the transcript will be posted to the COCA website at www.emergency.cdc.gov/COCA as they come to us. You have a year to obtain continuing education credits for this call. All continuing education credits for the COCA conference calls are issued online through the CDC Training and Continuing Education Online System. You can find that at www.2a.cdc.gov/TCEonline. And that wraps it up for today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.
Thank you for calling the Digital Replay Service.